Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for March's Exotics Club webinar. I'm delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club Clinical Manager at the Exotic Animal and Wildlife Clinic at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies, University of Edinburgh, Kevin Eatwell. Thank you, Kevin. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much. And today we're going to be discussing respiratory diseases of rabbits for this month's webinar. We do see a lot of respiratory disease in the rabbits, very, very common, and we do have to also think about how their respiratory system is different anatomically and how that can influence the severity of signs that we see, you know, can be particular to the rabbits. And rabbits really rely quite heavily on their diaphragm to breathe, and I guess that really puts us into two categories. We're looking at upper and we're looking at lower respiratory tract signs here. For the upper respiratory tract, we can get a lot of nasal and ocular discharges, some sneezing, some audible noise as well, maybe from them. Lower respiratory tract, we can get some coughing, but very, very unusual. And most of the rabbits, really, you're looking at the effort required into breathing, so you can get some quite forced respiration at this level. Cyanosis, obvious dyspnea, orthopnea, they may become anorexic, they may become depressed, they may have reduced fecal output, all of this sort of classical sort of, I guess, general signs of a rabbit being sick, and sometimes detecting respiratory disease can be quite subtle. They're not really as florid necessarily on some of the signs of lower respiratory tract disease that you compare to a dog and a cat, for example. So we have to start looking back at how rabbits are slightly different, and the first thing to be aware of is that these are near obligate nasal breathers. And what this means is if there is anything that is impeding a clear airflow through the nares or the nostrils, you can get quite a marked dyspnea as a result. Now, if you're looking at dogs, you're looking at cats, you're looking at people, we just mouth breathe. It's easy to bypass our upper respiratory tract. But for the rabbits, this is much harder. And so we can see this causing a more significant impact clinically than you would perhaps anticipate. We also have to be aware that infections that we can see causing problems in the nasal passages, obviously you have, in essence, bugs arising from the oropharynx, and it's very easy for these to pass up the eustachian tube to cause a middle ear disease as well, or tracking down the trachea leading to pneumonia as well. So we see a lot of upper respiratory tract disease linked with lower respiratory tract disease that's also linked with otitis media in these creatures as well. So it really can be a sort of a triad of all three that can be involved. Now, if we're going to auscultate our rabbits, then it can be sometimes difficult to fully evaluate. We have to appreciate that we have got compressed thorax due to the large size of the GI tract, so the thorax is more cranial than you would like. And in terms of auscultation, you do want to auscultate the entire lung surface on both sides. You can also auscultate over the trachea and also auscultate over the sinuses as well, which we'll come on to discussing later as well. One of the important things that is worthwhile doing also is to look for thoracic compressibility. And we use that a lot. If we get a reduced springiness in the ribs, then we're worried there is a thoracic mass, classically a thymoma or something along those lines, preventing chest compressibility, which we need to be aware of. Other thing worthwhile thinking about also is venous return from the head. So if we're taking a little bit to the aside, looking at thymoma or looking at heart disease maybe, you may have impaired venous return. And so you can get globe protrusion on both sides due to congestion in the venous plexus as well. So bear in mind that's something you may see with thoracic disease. And of course you may get with some of these, you may get weight loss. We may get signs of dacryocystitis. And if you're thinking that you might have an otitis media progressing to an interna present associated with infection, then of course we may start seeing some neurological changes as well in these cases. So if we start working your way, I suppose, from upper respiratory down to lower respiratory, then obviously looking for nasal discharges is common sense. And you may see a clear just fluid production, or maybe coming full on to a full sort of whitey or yellowy discharge as well. We do need to look for these for signs of dampness around the nose, but also for signs of discharges, which you can see around the nose, but certainly in severe cases, you'll see this also on the inside of the forepaws as well, where they've been wiping this discharge with their front feet. And of course, you can get quite marked dyspnea here. You may get, like I say, some audible noise, but maybe less likely, but quite often we'll see nasal flaring as they are trying to breathe quite forcibly in and out through the upper respiratory tract. Anorexia, like I say, may be associated with this, although that would be a severe case if an animal's become anorexic due to respiratory disease. A respiratory disease is normally quite markedly severe. If you've got unilateral disease, we then have to think about whether there's a foreign body in there or fungal infection. Viral diseases such as myxomatosis generally tends to be bilateral and more nodular in format. You may see trauma as well, which we can also get from things falling on the head. Less likely to be allergies, and maybe air hygiene is relevant as well in these. So, detailed assessment around the nares, looking for fluid or dampness suggesting this rabbit's been persistently wiping away any discharges here. In more severe cases, you will see that being present on the forepaws as well, so it's always worth having a little look down there. In other cases, you may start seeing increased effort and flaring around the nostrils here, increased movement around the lips as well, as this rabbit's trying to breathe in and out through an obstructive upper respiratory tract. And obviously tear duct flushing is on your list here. If you've got a nasal discharge, the question I want to ask is, has this come from the nasal chambers directly, or is this discharge coming from the tear duct? And so putting a little bit of proximetacaine into the tear duct, waiting 90 seconds for that to take effect, and then flushing this with some saline through to see that you're getting a free, easy flow from that tear duct, but also that the discharge, you know, the fluid coming through is clear, is very important to rule out a dacryocystitis. And this, of course, can be directly related if you have got tooth root involvement pushing into the sinuses or the rhinarium, then you can obviously get an impingement in your tear duct flow and have a rhinitis as well. So don't forget, one doesn't exclude the other, but it's information that we do need to know. And obviously, you're looking then for discharges coming out of the nares to confirm that you actually have, you know, a blocked or problem within that gland itself. And even though in some cases you may not see a discharge come out, the one thing you'll get in all the rabbits where you are flushing their tear duct is, much as you have put a local blockade into the eye, as soon as you get your saline trickling down into the rhinarium, because the rabbits are obligate nasal breathers, they will detect that and they will start looking like they're about to sneeze when it hits that, before you see the discharge coming out of the nares. So normally, based on rabbit behavior, you can tell as soon as you have got some of this discharge working its way down through the nares. So if we're looking at causes for rhinitis or sinusitis, then obviously a lot of these are bacteria. And depending on the references that you're looking at, Pasteurella is often yield is a significant factor here. And a lot of people instantly assume that a rabbit coming in with snuffles, as it were, is automatically Pasteurella, and therefore we need to be worried about this being spread between a group. But there's lots and lots of different pathogens that can lead to rhinitis and sinusitis, and ideally you want to be looking at getting a culture from that if you can do, or alternatively basing some presumptive treatment on the likely pathogens involved. And we'll come on to this a little bit later. Now, if you do have bacterial colonization in your nose and nasal chambers. We have to then think about severity and pathogenicity of these, and we can get ulceration of the mucosa. We can get infection tracking into the bone of the face, destruction of the nasal turbinate, so an atrophic rhinitis as well. And obviously this infection can, like I say, track into the middle ear or down the trachea, leading to a pneumonia as well. Although, to be fair, if you do have it tracking into a pneumonia, you generally then have a systemically ill rabbit that maybe is pyrexic. Whereas for a rhinitis, you tend to not have a sick rabbit per se, as the infection tends to be more localized, much as they are still dyspneic. So if you're looking then at saying, okay, you know, how do I know what bugs are involved in here? What do I need? Then, apart from imaging, which we'll come on to, ideally histopathocytology, confirming that you have an inflammatory response, ideally with bacteria being present or a marked neutrophilic response there, to suggest that the culture you've got is a real finding, versus and you're just growing something on culture because you can, because you've swapped the nose, as it were. So I think in practice, a lot of things would be, radiography would be your first port of call, to look at the nasal chambers. Ideally try and get some oblique views along with your DV and lateral views on there as well. Can be quite difficult if the disease is severe, you'll pick it up. You're looking for differences in density really across the radiographs, but in more mild diseases you can struggle to see that. So you do want to try and get the best images you can do radiographically to have a chance here. What these x-rays will show you is severity of dental pathology. They will enable you to identify how much the tooth roots are impinging on the nasal cavities, and this will be useful information. And if we think a bit more about the nasal anatomy, it will give you an indication of what's going on here a bit more. We know that air comes in through the external nares, goes into the nasal chambers. You then have two halves of this, hard palate below that, and then you have dorsal and ventral conchae present, endoturbinates more caudally. And then what you have also in addition to this is we have got the nasal paranasal sinuses here as well. So we've got the conchal sinuses and the maxillary sinus or maxillary recess on the lateral side. And these are quite important areas for you to be aware of, as these are not visible if you're doing rhinoscopy, for example. So just some pictures here, just having a little think of the anatomy for these here. Airflow coming in here through your nares, through your nasal conchae, working your way back to your endoturbinates at this point. And again, if we just look at this, when you're working your way through, when you're coming down and viewing, in essence, hard palate coming through here, followed by soft palate, working your way down to trachea here, you can see the distance is quite small here, and obviously for otitis, you're looking at creeping in at this point here. So really the distance you've got to go between these is quite limited, and so that's why these are all seen collectively. And in fact, it's the external nares that are actually one of the limiting points in terms of airflow through the rhinary of these guys. And you can see on the CT image here, this is quite a small point. Once you get beyond that in your rhinarium, you've got a much larger area with airflow coming through. So again, very easy to see. And if you do have the advantage of CT, obviously very subtle pathology, such as here where we've got some fusion of the turbinates, you can see, which you'd never detect radiographically. And moving slightly further back, you have got the conchal sinuses, one on each side sitting above the rhinarium. And again, that's not visible with an endoscope. And then you have your maxillary recesses, which really are an caudal extension of this down laterally here. Your drainage holes for these, unfortunately, are quite dorsal. So again, you know, similar to horses, you can get these filling up with infection with a very, very poor drainage point from them. And obviously then you're progressing further back into the turbinates and into the oropharynx at the back. And if we just have another little look at some pictures here, thinking about our anatomy, when you're trying to look radiographically, this is really what we're looking at here, trying to evaluate the density here. Looking at tooth root pathology here, maybe some of the tooth root pathology pushing up here as well being involved, particularly the first two premolars coming in there. And if we have a look at our anatomy now, we've got obviously lateral aspect we're looking at here, which is going to be your maxillary recess. Your contral sinus is going to be kicking in here, and your rhinarium obviously is in the middle of that. In terms of tooth root involvement, obviously the incisors are here, but your first two premolars sort of push up into the front edge of the zygomatic arch here and can be involved. If you're progressing further caudally here, your molar teeth tend to be exiting more in the orbit. So if you're going to blame cheek tooth pathology, it's generally premolar 1 and 2 that you need to be considering if you've got a rhinitis. And like I say, you've then got to have a look at your radiographs and try and make a judgment call on how severe you think those are. This is just a digital radiograph now looking at a rabbit with rhinitis. And what we're trying to decide is looking at the severity of pathology here. And I've been quite mean because I've just given you a straight lateral here. But if we actually reverse and look at the CT here, you can see we have severe unilateral disease here. And obviously you've got normal tissue behind it. So it can be very difficult sometimes to imagine the full extent of infection. And then here, the maxillary recess is full here. And we also have the contral sinus full as well. So this is, you know, the entire side has been completely obliterated by infection in this particular case. So even in the absence of having CT access, nasal endoscopy really is a very useful technique. And I suppose for me, when we're looking at these, I work that the CT is telling us anatomical changes or distortion. It's the endoscopy that's going to give me a diagnosis of histopath or cytology or a culture. And so even in the absence of CT, going in and doing nasal endoscopy will give you a good idea of the nature and extent of infection within the rhinarium at least. You will want a full GA for this. And I suppose the one good thing is if you're fairly happy that you're limiting to upper respiratory tract pathology in some of these cases, then once you have secured the airway, the rabbit actually is quite stable under anaesthesia. Different scenario with lower respiratory tract disease and pneumonia, but if it's upper, then you can bypass the area of concern, get a nice clear airway, good ventilation for the rabbit, and then you can do what you wish under anaesthesia. Your main concern point, obviously, with these cases is when you recover and extubate, that's when the rabbit may start having dyspneic episodes again because it's going very quickly revert back to nasal breathing. You can use lidocaine and things to provide analgesia. I tend to not use a lidocaine just simply for fear of interfering with culture growth. So maybe this is something you could do afterwards. That's simply something I wouldn't be perhaps doing beforehand just because of concerns of interfering with my diagnostic samples. But endoscopy works very, very well if you have the equipment for these cases. You also have the option of taking deep nasal swabs. If you don't have a small enough endoscope, then you can slide a swab to the back of the rhinarium. Here you're making the assumption that the infection is widespread and also what you're growing out on culture is real and meaningful. But in an ideal world, I guess what we would be rather doing is going in and visualizing this with an endoscope and confirming the nature and extent of pathology. And then if it was focal, we could consider selective biopsies of tissues for histopath and culture. Although the moment you start taking biopsies, you will get blood filling your rhinarium on the side that you're taking the biopsies, and that may limit your ability for visualization with the endoscope. So always biopsy last, I think, would be my advice to you. If you're looking and it seems to be quite widespread, then you could consider just coming out and taking a blind biopsy, feeling that you'd be fairly representative given the severity of change you've got here. You will fit a 2.7 endoscope into the Nares, but can be quite difficult based on size of the rabbit. So if you're going for deep nasal swabs, you do need to be measuring the length of your swab, so you know how far back you need to go in order to be sampling the right section, and you're aiming really to come in at the ventral aspect here to obtain your culture sample. The 2.1 mil endoscope actually is arguably better for these cases. You'll get a bit more space to maneuver around, although your biopsy size is limited down to 3 millimeters here. You'll get a 5 millimeter with a 2.7 mil endoscope. But nevertheless, if you can get in and have a look, that's obviously a good thing for these. If your noses are very small or you're thinking disease is widespread, either based on CT or based on your endoscopy, then we tend to go for the laparoscopic biopsies simply because these are a much larger biopsy size, more meaningful. And obviously you want to get mucosa and ideally cartilage, so you're getting a full thickness biopsy here for these cases. Again, under anesthesia for a detailed evaluation for analysis and sample collection. So bear in mind, they're going to bleed at you. So if you're going to go and get biopsies, biopsy is the last thing that you do after having evaluated the entire system and logged and recorded what you need to do, basically. Some people will use saline insufflation. I'm not a great fan of saline insufflation. And I guess, much as we secure our airways, in most rabbits you're using an uncuffed tube. And although you are pushing the soft palate up behind the glottis, by the nature of intubating, you have to push the soft palate up. There obviously still is a risk of aspiration here, so you have to be fairly happy that your airway is nice and secure if you want to use saline insufflation to remove blood and purulent material while you're evaluating the nose. In severe cases, I can see you needing to do that because of poor visibility, but please make sure that you're absolutely happy with your secure airway, and I would be intubating these. I wouldn't be relying on a V-gel or any other supraglottic device to be giving you the security you want if you've got lots of saline at the back of the oropharynx. So I suppose for my point of view, if you said what is the best way to diagnose disease and severity to give you a prognosis, then we would be doing CT with nasal endoscopy, obtaining biopsies and culture. In mild disease, like I say, your CT will sometimes give you a negative result. And that's if the nasal anatomy is within normal limits, or there's not that much in the way of discharges to be collecting within the sinuses for you to see. Endoscopy, of course, will pick up on subtle disease, but you cannot get into the contralateral sinuses or maxillary recesses. So again, CT allows me to look at the rhinarium and allows me to look at the contralateral sinuses here, whereas endoscopy only allows me to look at this area here. And if we move further back, again, with a CT, I can detailed evaluate the maxillary recesses. But my endoscope is still in this section here. I cannot gain access to this area. And again, you can work your way to the back of the oropharynx, but based on endoscope size, you really are quite limited to get this far back with the endoscope. So now if we start looking at underlying pathology here, think about your teeth and treat those as well, particularly if it's premolar 1 or 2, and incisors that may be relevant. So get those sorted out and dealt with during the process while you're here treating these cases. And medical therapy, I'd argue, is always worth a try for these cases in the first instance. What we can say is if you have got negative CT images, in other words, there's no anatomical change or you don't have access to CT, then if you can get a culture and biopsy, that's great. Ideally under sedation, as I said, more than just wiping a culture swab around the end of the nose, but it does depend on budget and finances and circumstances. And if you do get that and you treat based on your culture and sensitivity, we normally go for 4 to 6 weeks for this. And arguably, the rabbit should respond. In most cases, rabbits will clinically respond to antibiotic therapy. The question is, of course, is how long do they respond for? And that's the next thing that you've got to be thinking about. The sort of therapy that we're considering for these will ideally be systemic parenteral therapy. We use a lot of penicillin, but fluoroquinolones are also fine here. Sulfonamides are also okay. But equally, any of these options are suitable. Even oxytetracycline wouldn't be too bad a thing for the rabbits. And particularly if you're using long-acting oxytet, you can get away with injecting every 3 days, for example, which might make it practical for an owner that is struggling to inject at home. And then alongside that, we probably would be reaching for other adjunctive therapy. So nebulization is an option for you. Variety of things that we would use in nebulization. We can do it either in-house in a little dedicated carrier here, or you maybe want to use a little carrier at home. That's also fine, and we hire out or sell the nebulizers as well. Quite a variety of things that we can use in that, and obviously based on your culture, you might want to use things that could potentially be systemically toxic. You might get away with that. So things like amikacin, for example, where we'd be concerned about nephrotoxicity, you could nebulize, and as long as you're sticking below the systemic dose, will be a very safe way of administering that sort of product. We do use a lot of astaxanthin, which is a mucolytic, which works very quite nice in these for trying to soften things up and get things moving more. And some of these, because they're obligate nasal breathers, it may be more fluid and physical obstruction that's a problem here, alongside the infection per se, because they just can't breathe through their nose. And we also use things like F10 or antifungals as well through these as well, depending on what sort of pathogens you've got a suggestion are involved. And I think analgesia is important, or certainly anti-inflammatory properties of those are very useful as well. So a lot of these we will have on non-steroidals as well to try and ease the circumstance and make the rabbit feel better. And if we're concerned that we do have problems here with gut motility or gut stimulation, then we also will be adding in ranitidine, for example, to increase GI turnover. Mucolytics such as bromhexine are also used quite commonly. Again, these can be given orally, just a pinch a day, to try and break up mucus and get things to move and physically clear it. And I think if you have gone down this sort of route with these cases and treated quite extensively like that, and you have failed to get a clinical response, or you've got a clinical response but with a very quick relapse, maybe 2 weeks after treatment, month after treatment, 6 weeks after treatment, then a lot of people get very excited then about resistance being a factor. A lot of clients will come back and they're saying, well, can we try something else? And I think what I would encourage you at that point is you might find it's not resistance that's your problem. It might be severity of pathology that's your problem here. And the only way you're really going to know that, ideally, is by running a CT or convincing yourself, either on nasal endoscopy or on radiography, that the pathology is quite severe. And it may be you have the opportunity to do that. It may be you then turn around and think, okay, do I need to do something else here? And obviously, in a lot of rabbits with infections, we are looking at doing physical debridement of infection. That's almost a requirement, really, for these cases. So then you're coming back onto taking a surgical approach for these, and really, if you've got a lot of anatomical distortion or a lot of material, infective material building up, then you've kind of got to go down that route. If you're going in surgically, ideally do it prior to treatment, because you can take deep samples for histopath, culture, cytology, maybe allow you to get a sample from deep within the maxillary recess, for example, which you wouldn't be able to do with your endoscope, to evaluate the case further. You do need to know your anatomy, and there's dorsal or lateral approaches. I guess if you were going in without at access for CT, I probably would be looking at going in dorsally, simply because it gives you a few more options in terms of your you can extend this out into more areas of the nose if you need to. So if we look at the lateral approach, you're coming in basically into the maxillary recess that you've identified on CT as being infective, and you're going to eliminate it there, but this will only give you access to that maxillary recess. If we're looking at going in dorsally, you can see you basically can come in at this point, and obviously, if you're coming in here, you can get down into the rhinarium, but if I extend it caudally, I will come into the contralateral sinus as well. And then if I extend it laterally, I can get down into the maxillary recess as well. And of course, if I transfer over to the other side, I can do the same on the other side as well. So from a dorsal approach, you've just got to extend your bone trephining to reach other areas. And you could arguably do that blind if you really were forced into the circumstances. This is again just a labelled diagram now, just so you can get a feel for where your entry point would be, depending on which bit of the areas you were interested in surgically. And really, with these, there is some argument over terminology, which to some extent is irrelevant. You can either create a stoma, which means you can leave it permanently open to gain access for ongoing treatment, should you desire to do so, or you basically just make a rhinotomy and close it again and seal over the area afterwards. So you want to really be trephining dorsally, like I say, either directly into the contralateral sinus or into the nasal chambers and extend it in either direction that you need to. And if you extend that laterally, that will allow you access into the maxillary recess. And if we just have a little look at this sort of image here, you'll be able to palpate the nose and the start of the bone coming in here, back over to this section here. So really, your entry point you're looking at coming in here on your rabbit to get access to your sinus. And bear in mind, of course, you've got the eye here, your zygomatic arch feeding back where premolar 1 and 2 are, which really is the most caudal extent of your nasal chambers. So the contralateral sinus does come over the top here, but it's really that section. The bone here is quite thin as well. It's quite relatively easy to come through. We do block these out with lidocaine and bupivacaine. We use the lidocaine because it is quick acting, bupivacaine because obviously it's longer acting, will last up to 8 hours to block these. And again, make sure you're down onto the periosteum of bone to do that for them. You're then making a very small skin incision, lifting the subQ off the bone, and then you can start drilling. And we tend to just use a round-ended dental burr for these in our standard dental straight nose cone handpiece that you would use to burr a little hole down through into that area of interest. You can then get some rongeurs if you like, extend the area out to get better access, or use your burr to extend the area that you've opened. Again, just showing you straight in there to get your biopsy should you wish to, for culture, histopath, and cytology. And you can also pop your endoscope in as well, and you can actually get your endoscope if your hole is made slightly big enough. You can angle it and actually go down into the back of oropharynx as well to start looking in that area, which you couldn't get going via the nares. And having taken your samples and detailed the nature and extent of pathology, you're then saying, okay, great, I can now start doing some therapeutics really. And what you do need to do is to clean every single bit of infection out from here, from all areas really. And we normally would just use saline to insufflate through this and flush this system through. Again, you've got a secure airway. We'd probably do some suction and swabbing here to try and get as much out as we could do back out the surgical site to try and limit the amount flowing down the back of the soft palate, which of course the rabbit will be swallowing, or aspirating if you're unlucky. But you basically need to be removing all physical infection from this site until you're happy that you are down to just clear mucosa left. And having done that, the question then is what do I do with the hole? And like I say, if you leave this open, you're creating a stoma. That's topical treatment possibly, and in some cases you may want to put a catheter into here to continue to administer topical treatment. Certainly from a canine and feline point of view, recurrent ongoing topical treatment may not have a dramatic influence on the long-term prognosis, and more meticulous surgical technique is needed to help these out. The hole that you have drilled or made is not a hole that you can close, if that makes sense. You're going to be left with a bone deficit in the first instance. But obviously, if you do wish to close the skin over the top of that, then by all means, you're welcome to do so and leave it closed. You will get some paradoxical, almost, respiration in that area, in that when the rabbit breathes out, because it's an obligate nasal breather, you'll get a distension of your skin incision, and when it breathes in, you may get it sucking back into through this hole into the rhinarium, just again directly associated with breathing of the rabbit. That's perfectly normal. Ultimately, over time, that amount of response does settle, and they do grow back to normal, as it were, with no real movement of that skin area. But in the first instance, the owner's got to be aware that they will have changes above your rhinotomy site when the rabbit breathes. But like I say, you can instill catheters in these to leave them there as well, at again topical treatment should you wish to do so. And the wound again will eventually granulate once you've removed this as well. It's a question of how you feel you want to manage that case. I'd argue there's probably no need for ongoing topical treatment unless you have multi-resistance or other concerns. After surgery for these, we do have to be aware that the moment I have extubated, I am now pushing this rabbit into being a problematic clinical case because it's going to breathe through my surgical site. And obviously, if I have done it bilaterally, then I do have to be concerned that I may be causing significant compromise in this patient. So ideally, I do one side, but if you've got bilateral disease, you may as well do both when you're there, but just be aware of that as a complication and maybe try and ensure your airway is as clean as possible before you finish, that it's free of fluid, free of blood, and you're extubating at the last minute. And to some extent, there is a logic in just giving them some time for fluid and things to settle before you recover them from anaesthetic. And as I said, this is one of the downsides of being a near obligate nasal breather. Analgesia, very important. Okay, so non-steroidals are standard for these, along with your local, and we're also using opioids for these as well. Classically, these days, it probably would be methadone at 0.3 to 0.5 mg per kg every 4 hours in the first instance. Following that with buprenorphine, generally around the 0.03 mg per kg dosage. And once we're happy that the animal is ready for being discharged, then we'll be switching on to tramadol at 5 mg per kg twice a day per os at home for a few days afterwards for these. And if we're concerned we're causing a lot of trauma here, then we do use a lot of continuous rate infusions with dexmedetomidine, ketamine, and methadone, to be honest, during that process as well in the peri anaesthetic period for them. And like I say, don't forget using your local blockade. And because these, of course, are having an anaesthetic, then we will give them prokinetics as well for that process. They are or can be quite depressing. In that you're not going to get a magical cure rate with these, despite your efforts from the rhinotomy. These will still be on treatment for a month or 6 weeks afterwards, and sometimes you may get relapse or recrudescence of infection. Once you've got severe disease, it is very hard to satisfactorily eliminate that to any great degree. If we move on and have a little look at lower respiratory tract conditions now, you tend to find the rabbits are very good at hiding until disease is quite severe, and you can then get them presenting with marked dyspnea or orthopnea on arrival. Again, for me, I tend to distinguish two causes for these. If you're dealing with a severe bacterial pneumonia, you tend to have a sick rabbit. Maybe it's pyrexic, or maybe it's now gone hypothermic, but generally the rabbit is very classically sick, associated with this. If you're dealing with a rabbit with obstruction or due to a stricture, let's suggest, for example, or you've got a metastatic disease, or you've got a thymoma, in many cases your rabbit appears to be well, and whilst it is well coping with the level of pathology that it's got, the rabbit's eating, drinking, weeing, pooing, being quite normal, it's only when that disease has reached such severity that it's actually having a significant impact on the animal's ability to breathe, that then you get perhaps a more sudden presentation than you would anticipate with some of these cases coming in, where they've now reached the point of being at failure, and then obviously your treatment can be quite limiting because you're picking up disease quite late in that disease process. So you may see cyanosis being present. You may see marked orthopnea, where they're stretching and modifying their head position to try and ease breathing in this way. And again, you may get increased movements around the nares and the lips as well, where they're trying to draw more air through, or as much air as possible through the system. And your emergency therapy for cases of severe dyspnea really aren't that different to many other species. We certainly use a lot of oxygenation. We're nebulizing, maybe with mucolytics again here, where we're getting things settled down. You might reach for antibiotics. It's worth a thought. We do see acute pasteurilosis causing a pneumonia, but as I said, you might be able to pick the difference between, get a feel for the difference between a classical pneumonia sort of presentation versus some other form of presentation. Bronchodilators, mucolytics can all be added into that if you feel there's a significant fluid component here. If you're thinking heart disease might be relevant, then maybe some diuretics. And we do occasionally use some midazolam and things to take the edge off of the animal so they can breathe a bit more sensible. And those of you that are using capnography on the rabbits, for example, for anaesthetic monitoring, you'll know once you have them at a deep or a suitable plane of anaesthesia, you have a very nice capnograph coming through, sensible end tidal values. They're clearing that out, going back to zero before the next breath is being taken, so on and so forth. But the moment that rabbit starts to become light and starts to get, if you like, a stress or a pain response, then you'll get them hyperventilating. And on those, your end tidal tends to drop down a bit and you tend to get more rebreathing in those cases. And it may be, if you've got serious compromise, that isn't helpful for effective gas exchange. And so actually lowering down the rate of respiration by just making the rabbit relax a little bit might actually allow them to draw deeper breaths with greater gas exchange for them. So it is worthwhile considering, but I obviously would have an IV line and be very careful with your dosing regime for these if you're going to go down that route. And basically for these cases, your first port of call is imaging. Radiography, I would say, would be generally adequate here. We do a lot of CTs as well for them because we can do, and I guess for the CT, the advantage is if they're conscious, you've got less concern with respiratory compromise. Whereas if you're going to use radiography, you've got to get clinically useful radiographs without compromising that patient, and that can be sometimes challenging. And do you really want to anaesthetize this patient? I suspect not. We're going to be looking at trying to get conscious x-rays. And again, you're also probably going to not be able to have adequate ventilation in the lungs as well. So, okay, yes, if I've anaesthetized it, yes, if I've intubated it and I've ventilated this chest and got ventilated radiographs, and that's going to give me the maximum chance of getting a really lovely interpretation of those radiographs, but practically that may not be possible. So for a lot of these, if we are trying to get a very quick answer, then we would use horizontal beam radiography for these. And what you're basically doing is getting the eyes covered, keep the nares clear. And with a lot of these dyspneic rabbits, if you do move the front legs forward and elevate the chest, really for the purposes of getting better radiographic images, you will also ease their breathing as well. It's a position that a lot of these rabbits will want to sit in for facilitating their breathing whilst you're getting your images as well. So these can work quite nice to get clinically useful images that you can start interpreting. And I suppose the main thing when you're looking at these is to say, okay, what can I look at? What things can help me make a diagnosis here? And on this particular image, the things that I look at and interest me first up is your trachea. And what we can say definitively is that this trachea is not elevated in this rabbit. Despite the leg being in the way and interfering my ability to see the cranial lung fields, this has not been elevated. And if I had a cranial thoracic mass or a big heart, this should be elevated. And the carina, which is here, probably also would be pushed caudally. So look at your carina and look at your trachea to see if you've got any evidence of displacement of that on your radiograph, which you'll detect whether your legs are in the way or not. And then obviously what you're looking then for is diaphragm, trying to get a feel that everything is intact here. And then you're looking at level of aeration and changes within the lung fields, as we have in this particular case here. A lot of cases with metastasis, you're seeing much larger cannonball sort of style changes in the lung fields. Again, this trachea isn't elevated here, but we've got a lot of soft tissue within the fields going on there behind that. And if again, now looking at a thymoma, this is a rabbit under anaesthesia here that's been intubated, but straight away we have got tracheal elevation right the way along the dorsal aspect here, and we have got the lung fields up more dorsally here as well. So we know there is elevation pushing that trachea up and their soft tissue density here. So even with the legs were, this was a conscious one, you'd still get that trachea being elevated at that point. Other things you can do for these, you can consider using capnography for getting an idea of level and severity of ventilation, I guess, or oxygenation if you want to use your pulse oximetry as well. That can be quite useful. Blood gas, probably gold standard for this, really. Tracheal washes are great. You want an anaesthetic for these, but if you're thinking you're concerned you've got a primary bacterial problem here, then going in and doing a tracheal wash or going in endoscopically, for example, and getting a tracheal wash via the endoscope sheath could be done. Your 1.9, 2.1 scope will fit in easily with the sheath in place, or you'll get the 2.7 down without a sheath in place for these, but you will be pretty much obscuring the airway completely in these, and with a dyspneic patient you do have to be concerned. What we have done with these, which has worked really nicely, is if we've used a smaller endoscope with a surgical sheath on, we've actually managed to oxygenate and anaesthetize through that surgical sheath using that as an ET tube for our rabbit patients, which actually has made quite a big difference to keeping them stable under anaesthesia whilst we are collecting diagnostic samples, whether that be a bronchoalveolar lavage or whatever else is going on. And obviously, having got that sample, that's cytology, that's culture, that's culture and cytology on your wash that you have acquired. And if you're seeing fluid, we do see a fair few of these with fluid in chest, or we see a fair few pneumothoraxes as well in the rabbits these days as we're evaluating them in more detail. And your standard approach for draining fluid and sending it for analysis obviously can be done. You'll see a lot of exudates or transudates here, some pyothoraxes, some hemorrhage as well. But obviously cytology and fluid analysis is important from anything that you acquire. Pneumothorax we do see as a consequence of trauma. And again, you'll see that if you've got lung damage from that, or to some extent if you've got bullous changes within your lung that then leads to pneumothorax from chronic infection and inflammatory change in the lung, you can also see that as well. And in severe cases, you can just get peracute death from severe pasturella. It's something that you just cannot really account for. There's a load of bacteria that may lead to disease, so don't forget your special staining for these as well. And don't forget, we may have myxomatosis present as well, leading to changes. The only other one worth mentioning is rabbit hemorrhagic disease, which, of course, again, if you're seeing that, you're going to see a per-acute pulmonary hemorrhage, depending on which variant you are getting coming through. Neoplasia, thymoma, more common than you think, maybe, for you to be looking at as a rule-out. Metastatic disease from uterine adenocarcinoma, but we see this as other causes as well. Lymphosarcoma we see as well, and other neoplasia as the rabbits are getting older, I suppose, as the population is shifting, we're seeing more neoplastic conditions as well. Don't forget, if you have got compression of your venous return from your head, you are going to get congestion of the venous plexus behind the eye, which may lead to third eyelid gland protrusion, or alternatively, you may have protrusion of the orbit as a whole associated with that. And again, on post-mortem, you may have some severe cases that really have been pretending to be normal. And obviously here we've got lots of pathology in liver, but also throughout lung fields as well. And this again was a sudden emergency case that was presenting. So do still think about toxins here. Do think about allergies, heart disease, particularly think about heart disease as well, or free thoracic fluid. If you're doing horizontal beam, of course, if you've got thoracic fluid, you'll see a very clear fluid line, which if you're doing a lateral view, then you just get a white out of the entire surface, really. So that is the end of our webinar on respiratory disease today. I just have one question, really, that was raised about concerns about how you really deal with these clinically in practice. And I think, for me, you're used to dealing with respiratory tract diseases and problems, and your approach to these cases can mirror what you're doing for the dogs and cats in terms of your diagnostics and in terms of your supportive care. I suppose the differences that we start to see with the rabbits really is knowing which diseases are more common and obviously treating them like a rabbit as well. So, you know, your management maybe of that animal can slightly vary based on its post-operative care or peri-anesthetic care. But the basic principles of how you're going to approach a dyspneic case and work one up is identical for dog and cat, really, to some extent, in terms of how you approach them. I'm now going to pass back to Emma, and thank you all for attending.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Kevin for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.